So, if I can venture into the territory of opinion for a few moments.
When did we get out of this?
The Popstorian Podcast with Chris and Ben.
Wait a minute. You ain't heard nothing yet.
Greatest crash in the history of the New York Stock Exchange and market.
A date which will live in infamy.
I have a feeling we're not in Kansas anymore.
What are you supposed to do when you see the flash?
Duck and cover.
I'm sorry, Dave. I'm afraid I can't do that.
It's one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind.
Well, I'm not a crook.
Might have gotten away with it, too. If it wasn't for these blasted kids and their dog.
Mr. Gorbachev, tear down this wall.
The evil of the river.
I can hear you. The rest of the world hears you.
Great power comes great responsibility.
I didn't like this movie very much.
I could tell.
I confess. I've avoided telling you till now.
No, I can tell.
But you figured it out.
We need to have like a mini-sode about our taste in movies, because I think it would be an interesting conversation, because we've actually watched two movies recently.
Yeah, well, we recently watched Alien.
Yeah.
That was kind of unrelated.
One of your favorite films, apparently. Yeah,
which is one of my favorites. But you hated it.
I didn't hate it. I would totally watch it again with you. but I really didn't like it that much.
Yeah, that's fair. But I feel the same way about this. Like, I feel like this is a great movie, but it's not my great movie.
Right.
And one of the reasons that one of the things about it that bothers me so much is you can tell, even if you're not familiar with the backstory or the history, because I wasn't when I sat down and watched it, that John Wayne is making a statement about masculinity and what it means to be a sheriff in a small town, and that's sort of like, I don't know, that's sort of like authority and responsibility and all those concepts.
Right.
Are swirling around
honor and virtue and these kind of things.
Honor and virtue. All those themes are kind of swirling around, which are some of my favorite themes in Westerns. And I think themes that Westerns tackle better than almost any other genre. But ultimately, he comes across quite weak to me as a character. Even in the opening montage, the opening 10-minute sequence or so with no dialogue, he shows up armed, ready to take in the bad guy, and what does he get? He gets hit over the head with a log.
From his own deputy, no less.
From his own deputy. So immediately, right off the bat, he doesn't come across as like a strong, in-control kind of character to me.
Right.
And then throughout the film, he has a bunch of other weaknesses, too. Like, he always carries a rifle.
Mm-hmm.
And someone asks him at one point, why do you carry a rifle? And he says, well, I can shoot better with it than I can with the pistol.
Well, yeah, so he admits his weakness there. He says some that were faster with a short gun.
Yeah, yeah. He says other people were faster with a short gun, and I found I was faster with the rifle.
Yeah.
So he's got that weakness. And the whole film is kind of like him getting into scrapes and then other people getting him out of it. So he gets the bad guys get the drop on him by impersonating dude. And then he's saved by a woman wielding a flower pot and a pop star with two pop guns. So there's that. And then, of course, he's saved in the end by Stumpy.
Yeah.
It just kind of compounds to this sort of... He's almost necessitated. The filmmakers are almost necessitated by the rules of storytelling to counteract the message that they're trying to say. In a way, because the message, I'm assuming, and maybe this is a mischaracterization of what they're trying to say, but it seems to me that the message is a man should be strong and stand firm in the face of adversity without dragging in all these other weaker people who deserve protection. Is that a mischaracterization?
Well, I disagree with you on a couple points. One is, I don't know if it's telling that everybody else around him is weak. They're just not professional. In, his realm of his profession. It'd be like you inviting me onto a movie set and expecting me to perform at the same level you are. So it's like, he's not necessarily saying that they're lower than him. They're just saying that they're not geared towards the same goal as he is.
Right.
And I think that was kind of the one of the main points, is that he was a professional, and that's why he was he's refusing all this help. That he feels like he's better off with other professionals.
Right.
And it's interesting because he surrounds himself with people with weakness too.
Mm-hmm.
His two deputies, one is he's an old gimp,
mm-hmm.
and the other is a drunk.
Yeah.
Which
I think comes to that, which is why I get the whole vibe of protecting those that are weaker than you.
Which, I think that's a major theme in the film, is that
yeah.
he's taking these other guys under his wing, that
mm-hmm.
he can protect them.
And yet,
saving him.
Every time it comes down to the wire, he always fails, and they always come to his aid and save the day.
And I also want to add Colorado, who's a young up-and-comer.
Uh-huh.
He's kind of learning lessons here as well.
Yeah.
But I do want to point out, can you imagine this film without the sheriff, though? Can you imagine this, if this were a different film, if John Wayne's character dies in the first 5 minutes of the film,
mm-hmm.
do you think Dude,
if he
Stumpy...
died from that log over the head.
Exactly. If Dude, Stumpy, and Colorado, can they finish it out?
Well, I feel like his role in this film, I feel like they could finish out a different movie.
Right.
But, so it would obviously change the movie a lot.
Which it would change the movie a lot.
But I don't think it would be a bad movie.
Well,
if he got killed in the opening scene.
My point is that he is the hub that brings
yeah,
these other characters
around. And
he
gives the other characters someone to talk to. Like,
right.
I think, for me, the most interesting character of the main ones, not counting Stumpy, because
mm-hmm.
I love Stumpy, but he doesn't really have anything much to do.
Right.
Other than say, like, funny one-liners, and he has, like, one brief moment of backstory that's really interesting.
Mm-hmm.
But to me, the most interesting character in the piece is Dean Martin's character.
Yeah.
Who has this sort of, like, battling to overcome alcoholism, even though I pointed out when we were watching it, we don't ever actually see him drink any liquor. he drinks some beer.
He drinks some beer. That is a good point.
But yeah, if he didn't have the sheriff as sort of like an older brother figure to kind
mm-hmm.
of talk to and turn in his resignation to at one point, which doesn't really stick. Yeah, there would be no drama to that character.
That's
so that's sort of the role that John Wayne's character plays in this movie.
And I think that is because of John Wayne's age.
This is
getting to where he's getting older. He's not really at the height that he had brought in 1939 Stagecoach. He's this young actor. The 40s.
This is 20 years after.
This is 20.
Coast.
Yeah, he's gotten a lot older, so his parts are changing here. If
mm-hmm.
you kind of look at his career as a whole, his parts will change. And it's interesting that his as an actor does that. He doesn't. I mean, we make fun of him as being this action hero,
right.
70 years old, but he does. His parts do change.
Yeah,
and I think that's an interesting aspect of the story, is that I think you're seeing a transition for John Wayne's career.
Yeah, it's. I feel like he gets some criticism and some flack for not being a good... People accuse him of not being a very good actor.
Yeah.
Partially because he has sort of, I guess, a rigidity to his style.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think there is a rigidity there.
But I don't know that it's a bad thing, per se, in and of itself.
He's still being talked about. Just like... 30, 40 years after he's dead,
yeah.
So...
There's clearly something there, beyond just...
And I want to say that's really just where how he came up in the industry.
Hmm.
That he comes in the system, like the Hollywood system, where you had your own contract, and they typecast you.
Mm-hmm.
Like, this is your character, on screen and off.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of it. If you look at a lot of other actors, Cary Grant, for instance, he had the Cary Grant character. If he,
yeah.
On or off camera.
Mm-hmm.
And people don't complain about his acting. I'm just saying, laying that out.
That's
here.
True. That's true.
But I think that's part of it. And the other part is that who he chose to align himself with, who he chose to look
right.
to as role models for his acting.
Yeah.
A big one being John Ford.
Mm.
I think his relationship with John Ford was very important to him in his life.
Yeah.
And just looking at John Ford and kind of his personality and the way he came up,
mm-hmm.
you kind of see where John Wayne or Ward Bond even, why their careers took a certain way.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's very interesting to explore the the kind of like the reality of John Wayne and the myth of John Wayne.
He's a very interesting figure in that way, and he's not a perfect fella at all.
No,
complicated in many ways.
Yeah. He's received a lot of criticism, I think, about a year ago. Someone dug up an old Playboy interview that he did.
I heard about that.
It was very strange to me because he's been dead for a long time.
Well, that was not to get too political, but that had been a theme for quite a few years by that point. People were talking about older historical figures and saying, well, they're not enlightened, they're not progressive. We need to take their names off of certain things. And they were trying to take his name off of an airport in I think Los Angeles or someplace.
Uh-huh.
And so that came up out of that. I'm not sure the motivation behind it or anything, but yeah, his name does pop up.
Mm-hmm. And, very controversial figure
in many ways. Particularly in the 1950s when you have the Red Scare going on, he is kind of applauding the blacklist and things mm-hmm. like that. And that's kind of put a mark on his career after his life.
Yeah, it's almost kind of equating all the virtues that he extols on screen as being essential to being an American, or almost making those two things as if they're the same.
He does, and almost making, there's a lot of interviews and a lot of analysis of his career that he really kind of looked at Hollywood with a certain awe. Like he always come, people say he's always professional, he'd always come on set, know his lines.
Hmm.
He really felt very strongly about films that he didn't feel honored the history or the what he thought was the right way to do a movie
mm-hmm.
or the storylines and things like that.
Hmm.
I think he aligned that with his politics as well, and the way he thought an American should be and how an American should act and believe and things like that. So no, it is an interesting look at his life there.
Yeah. And is this about, trying to think, this would be more towards the end than towards the middle of his life, because he dies in, what, 1979?
79. He would be 20 years.
So 20 years before his death.
Yeah.
But still an interesting point to look at his life. So he starts out kind of as a B-movie actor.
Yeah.
Working for Republic Studios.
By this point, I think in his career, he had done something like 140 movies or something like that.
Something
like
outlandish.
Crazy amount of movies, because mm-hmm. he was doing all these B-movies and serials and things.
Yeah. Which I think there's a certain amount of professionalism that came out of that world, too.
Right.
Of having to, because if you didn't, then there wasn't a movie.
Yeah, you couldn't really afford to be
someone dropped,
a diva at all.
If someone dropped the ball on being professional in the movie, and I've seen this happen on movies that I've worked on, too.
Right.
If someone drops the ball and there's not a lot of money, then it costs the whole production.
You can't
a
fix
ton.
That in post.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
And of course, in those days, there wasn't a whole lot of post options anyway.
Right. And
for fixing things.
And the filming schedules are so tight.
Yeah.
Like, Real Broad was considered kind of a big budget. It had like 65 days to shoot. I don't know.
That's really quick.
That is a fast shoot, but that was a big picture in the 1950s.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you're looking at the early days of film. You knocked out a film in like a week or two.
Mm-hmm. Or in the silent days, sometimes in one day.
Exactly. So, like, the way he comes up in the industry.
Yeah.
You know. Well, I don't want this to be completely about John Wayne.
Yeah, let's talk about some of the other the other personalities and stuff involved. Lee Brackett is someone I want to talk about.
Okay.
Lee Brackett is one of the two screenwriters, the other being Jules Furthman. Lee Brackett is one of my favorite writers, and I think she's mostly responsible for some of the dialogue that I love in this movie. She wrote another movie called The Big Sleep for Howard Hawks, which is adapted from a Philip Marlowe novel, starring Humphrey Bogart and Lauren Bacall. And she writes The Long Goodbye, which reprises the same Sam Spade detective character many years later with Elliot Gould in the 1970s.
Huh. I really want to see that movie now.
Yeah, it's a great movie. Yeah. It's directed by Robert Altman, who directs the MASH.
I need to see
film.
More Robert Altman. I need to see a lot of his
movies. Yeah, he's got a very interesting style. People often talk over each other, and it's almost like documentary-esque. But it's also, he's also very, he's very liberal, so he's got a very irreverent...
There's a lot of politics in his film.
There's a lot of politics, but it's sort of like fly-on-the-wall politics. Kind of like, almost, the camera's almost as an observer in situations. And she also worked on, one of the last projects she worked on before she died, a science fiction project called The Empire Strikes Back.
What is that?
That's a sequel to Star Wars, a film that came out in the 70s that we're going to talk about later on this podcast.
Yeah, I don't think anyone's seen that.
No, kind of obscure. So that's an interesting connection between Rio Bravo and Star Wars.
Who knew?
The sort of wide-ranging... And she also was a prolific writer of science fiction short stories, Lee Brackett was.
Oh, wow.
Although The Empire Strikes Back was the only, like, film connection that she has to science fiction.
So is this early in her career, or is it... Like, she got pretty big billing on the credits.
Yeah, so this would be, I guess, the midpoint on her career. I think she starts writing in the early 40s. And she just was writing sci-fi for the pulps. And eventually, you know, being in the area of Los Angeles, she got connected with the movie business and, yeah, wrote some of these great classics of cinema that kind of span multiple eras, in a way.
So she did a lot of Howard Hawks films. She did The Big Sleep.
Not too terribly many films. Those four are the big ones. I think there's a few others. She worked on, or with William Faulkner, on a script. And she ghost wrote or co-wrote some other films. The remake of this film, El Dorado, and Rio Lobo, the other remake of this film.
So that is also something else I wanted to circle back.
Yeah, let's dive into that real quick.
So this film actually has a very long... lasting legacy.
It does.
Howard Hawks remakes this film twice, as you just mentioned.
Mm-hmm.
I think you like El Dorado better, I think you said.
I do. I have fond memories of watching El Dorado as a kid, so I have a more rose-tinted glasses towards it, I think.
I think of the three, I really like Rio Bravo, but El Dorado is probably the second. Rio Lobo, I think it just, I don't know, it's very different. I don't know, have you seen this? Have you seen Rio Lobo?
I've not seen Rio Lobo.
I think it's one of Howard Hawks' last films, actually.
Mm-hmm.
And I think he's trying to tap into the changing Western scene that happens in the late 60s and 70s. So a little bit more gritty, which we'll talk about next time. I think.
El Dorado, at least in my memory, has a lot more action. And it's got James Caan in it.
Very young James Caan.
Very young. Plays sort of the Ricky Nelson character.
His name is Mississippi.
His name is Mississippi.
Colorado, Mississippi.
Yeah. Also named after a state. But the interesting thing about that character is that he can't shoot.
Right.
He can't shoot at all.
Which is kind of like the opposite of Ricky Nelson's character. I didn't put the two together.
John Wayne makes him a sort of pistol out of a sawed-off shotgun.
Well, he buys it off of the gunsmith in this one town. one of my favorite weapons of all time.
It's one of my favorite movie weapons, because it's just this handheld, basically just blaster that he's literally blowing things up.
Yeah.
That was sort of an aside.
Yeah.
But yeah, so it's got a long legacy with these.
But a little bit later on, one of your favorite directors, John Carpenter.
Yes.
We'll kind of bring the concept back.
John Carpenter does an excellent version of this kind of story in a contemporary, what was then contemporary setting, late 70s.
Precinct 13.
Assault on Precinct 13, which has been remade itself.
It was remade, yeah. I forget who starred in the film, though.
I think it's Ethan Hawke.
Ethan Hawke did it, right. The remake.
Does a remake of Assault on Precinct 13 in, like, 2005, I think.
Yeah.
But yeah, Assault on Precinct 13 is interesting. It's a very low-budget movie. It was early in Carpenter's career before he had a lot of big-budget movie success and some cult 80s hits. And it's a black sheriff.
Okay, I've not seen the original.
The hero character of that is black, and it takes place kind of on an inner city. And this gang is basically taking over this precinct that's shutting down.
Yeah.
The precinct is being shut down and they want to take it over. And there's a few people trapped in there with him, and it's got a lot more of the siege warfare element to it. It's also a little bit slow, I think, by modern standards. Assault on Precinct 13 is.
We should watch it.
We should definitely watch that and talk about it. We could do an entire series just on remakes of Rio Bravo.
Yeah, that's kind of true. I was thinking of another film. I caught the last a few minutes of the movie SWAT. It was a Colin Farrell, Samuel Jackson.
Mm-hmm.
Are you familiar with the film?
I haven't seen it. Is it more recent?
It is a very recent movie. Yeah. Okay. And it. I was thinking that it also had kind of that element from Rio Bravo as well, because the bad guy that they're transporting offers like $1 million reward for his escape or something like that.
Yeah.
And I feel like that is also kind of one of those things that pops up in a lot of modern movies or a lot of action films like this, which is kind of reminiscent of Rio Bravo's storyline as well.
We want to touch on the character Feathers.
You know, this is actually probably, like you said, this is your first or probably only Angie Dickinson film.
Yeah.
And I think this is probably the only one I've watched too. I mean, I haven't really seen a whole lot of Angie Dickinson.
Yeah.
She's a fantastic actress. Just doing
really
work.
She has a lot of moments where she just kind of talks. And he just kind of listens. Stoically.
Which is, I think, Howard Hawks coming through.
Yeah.
Because he's, like I said, he's kind of known for making his female characters as strong as the male characters.
Yeah.
And John Wayne, he tried to fit his films to the personalities of the actors that he was bringing up here. So Humphrey Bogart's characters are different, but he's playing to Humphrey Bogart's strengths. In this film, I think he plays to John Wayne's strengths as being this kind of character. I think as Angie Dickinson actually described him as the kind of guy that would be like, punch something and then get back up and you punch it again, kind of a actor.
Yeah.
So I think this is Howard Hawks really trying to play to both of their strengths.
Yeah. The interesting thing is with My Darling Clementine had a female character that sort of felt shoehorned in.
Yeah, they had two female characters.
Clementine.
It's Clementine is the titular character, but also Chihuahua.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel like both of these actresses didn't get their due in
those films. Well, they're films about masculinity and masculine themes.
Right.
This film, I think, even more so, because it's trying to answer what was perceived as a more, I guess, feminine?
I don't know if I'd call it feminine, but definitely a different...
Less macho.
a less macho would probably... I wouldn't call it feminine by any stretch.
But less macho.
But less macho kind of outlook.
So it's trying to answer that piece of work. But then you have this strong Hawksian woman whose story doesn't really... Clementine was connected to Doc Holliday directly in that story.
Yeah.
She knew him from back east, and that's why she was there. And of course, she falls in love with the sheriff, just like Angie Dickinson's character does here.
Except but it kind of cut out the Doc character, who actually, I guess, is killed in her backstory.
Yeah, it doesn't. It doesn't tie in exactly, but there's a lot of similarities. But yeah, like you were saying, the Doc character isn't a part of this story at all. Yeah. So there's nothing really tying her to this town other than her relationship with John Wayne and the scenes that she has with John Wayne.
Right.
And I feel like those scenes, as I mentioned, I think earlier, feel a little forced to me.
I don't know.
Partially because of the age difference between them.
Well, the age difference is kind of hard to overcome. I mean, it's been done in other movies too, and particularly this era.
I think it's been done better.
One thing I think kind of plays to why she stays in town is the scene where she offers him a drink. It's late. He's coming back to the hotel. And she said, I didn't realize, you know, how much trouble you were in. And then he's like, oh, don't worry about it. And he kind of is nice to her. And he says that he's going to rip up his handbill is why he pulls her over. And she kind of looks at it and is like, oh, well, if I go somewhere else, the handbill might still be there and the sheriff might not be as nice.
Yeah.
And he's like, she's like, well, this is as good a town as any to settle in.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know if they were explicit in that, but that's kind of the take I took on it.
Yeah.
And I feel like that's Howard Hawks again, kind of. He's, in this film anyway, I felt that he was very good at moving pieces and kind of subliminally
kind of
making his points and not being so, like, some parts he's very
right
in the face with it. Like, there's a lot of exposition, a lot of backstory in a lot of these characters. But then there's other parts, key plot points that he just kind of lets it go like it was a silent movie. And you're supposed to just follow along.
Yeah.
And I think...
It's an interesting movie. I want to find a copy of it that has some sort of commentary.
Yeah.
So I can watch it again with a commentary and see if I can get a little bit more analysis while I watch it.
Yeah.
Because I didn't watch it under the best of circumstances. I think I was coming back from work.
Going to a job.
Going to another job.
Watching
took
it
a break and watched a movie.
While my two daughters screamed in your ear.
So I definitely do want to watch it again and reevaluate it at some point.
Yeah.
If I should get the opportunity.
Was there another aspect of the film that you wanted to cover before I move
before
on?
Before we move into our historical portion?
Yeah.
I will say, I do also prefer, in the 50s, there's a bunch of, or a few movies like High Noon, like 310 to Yuma.
Right.
That are very small, have a few characters, they're in black and white, and they're kind of known as, like, the psychological westerns.
Yeah, which I think is another film, I don't remember if Howard Hawks or John Wayne didn't like it, but I think that's another film that gets lumped in with High Noon.
310.
310, yeah.
Yeah, 310 to Yuma.
I've seen the remake, I didn't see the
310 to Yuma is one of my favorite westerns.
The original?
The original, yeah.
Okay.
So I love, and I love High Noon too, so I love the kind of movie that they're bashing here. Not really for political reasons so much as it is just interesting character studies and exercises and building tension. I don't feel like this film builds tension quite as well.
It doesn't, and I think that...
Part of that's our age.
Well...
Because it's,
I guess that's true.
It's maybe slower moving.
Maybe that's the it. I'm not sure. But I was thinking about this film, and I didn't notice that there were parts in it that really could have used more tension and more suspense. And it just kind of plods along. It has a song here or there. It's not... It doesn't grab you and keep you on the edge of your seat in a lot of ways.
Yeah. It's not the way that something like The Searchers does.
The Searchers does that. I was actually thinking it in comparison to a film that's way out of the box, like Alien. Like Alien, I think, is the pinnacle of that kind of grabs you and then never lets you go.
Yeah.
And this, I think that's one thing that they could have done better in this film. Not that I'm telling Howard Hawks how to do his job, but I would have liked to see a little bit more tension build in the film.
Yeah, me too.
Still
enjoy it. Still a classic.
Still one of my favorites.
Love freaking Walter Brennan, man.
I don't know how you can not like Walter Brennan. Any character that he does. Like, he was in My Darling Clementine. He is probably one of the great shining moments of that film.
Yeah. I think he was a great shining moment in both of these movies.
Yeah.
So do you want to delve into some of the historical context?
I do.
See, is there anything else we need to say about the film?
I didn't have anything else. But the 1950s are a really tough time to nail down. I know today we kind of have this automatic image of Leave It to Beaver.
Yeah.
Kind of 1950s deal. Levitt Town and all that. But a lot's going on here politically and socially. It's all under, President Eisenhower, where most of it is. Truman takes over after Roosevelt dies in office. Truman will win a second term, and he'll finish that out until 52. And then Eisenhower takes over. And Eisenhower is in office for two terms into the 60s. And as far as political goes, he's a Republican, but he's all about physical responsibility. But he's very much about social programs. Like, he wants to continue some of the New Deal things.
I don't know if progressivism is the word, but...
I don't think progressivism has really kind of reached this far out, is what we would know as progressivism.
Yeah, it doesn't really exist yet. But I would say that he's very into the idea of stewardship.
I think that's probably
taking care of our own.
I think that's probably a good deal. But he's also not an isolationist either.
Right.
Because the Marshall Plan continues. Right. Europe is being rebuilt at this time.
Mm-hmm.
I really enjoyed it anyway. The biography that I read about Eisenhower, or at least skimmed through it, was called Age of Eisenhower, America and the World in the 1950s by William I. Hitchcock. I really enjoyed it. And actually have a quote here from the book talking about the economy, because this is another thing about the 1950s that we kind of talk about a lot, is that it's such a rich time. Like, literally, the GDP is
mm-hmm.
really good here.
Yeah, it's sort of, a lot of people talk about it as sort of the emergence of America as a superpower.
Yeah, and I think Hitchcock really sums it up really well, so I'm going to give a direct quote from him.
Mm-hmm.
Does Eisenhower deserve the credit for his prosperity, for this prosperity? Not entirely. America benefited in the 1950s from many positive trends that owed nothing to Ike. Now, we're just talking about Ike there.
Mm-hmm.
A growing population, a better educated one, pent-up demand among consumers after 15 years of hardship, mm-hmm. cheap oil, energy, innovation in technology and science, and the creation of vast market consumer goods stimulated by the rapid expansion of advertising industry. The global picture was also favorable. Germany and Japan, which would challenge American economic dominance after the 1970s, still face formidable domestic reconstruction problems.
Mm-hmm.
And the world economy all ran on the dollar, supporting America's ability to export its wares around the world. And the country enjoyed a healthy trade surplus throughout the decade. In such circumstances, perhaps any president would look good. And that is a direct quote from Hitchcock in his book, which I think sums up the economy situation very well.
Yeah.
So we're coming out of World War II.
Mm-hmm.
The world is a mess. Our industry is booming because mm-hmm. all those GIs are coming home.
Yeah.
The baby boom is well on its way. So all those factories are not winding down. They're actually just changing over to automobiles. Everybody has a car. Actually, I do have some statistics on that as well.
This is kind of a shift, too, towards, the real emergence of suburbia.
It is.
Suburban communities.
As another book I was reading called The Enduring Vision kind of names it the affluent society.
Yeah.
By the end of the decade, about 60% of American families owned homes. 75% wow. owned cars. 87% at least one TV. So you kind of see these are
by the end of the decade.
Wow. By the end of the decade. So these are things that you might have not seen in the 1930s or very rarely in the 1940s. Here's another.
Yeah, before the war, we were in the midst of a depression still.
Right.
So there's a lot of hard times and scarcity, and then...
And then the war hits, and there's more hard times and scarcity. So
yeah.
they're breaking out here, and they're like, we want this, and we want that. Here's some more economy things here. The gross national product in 1950 was $285 billion. By 1960, that had doubled to $500 billion. That's
wow.
that's the gross national product right there.
Wow.
Home ownership in 1950 was 48%, 53% by 1960. These are some other sets of statistics. By 1960, 87% of households owned a television, which we talked about a second ago. In 1950, 59% of families owned a car. By 1960, 73%. So you can kind of see
mm-hmm.
the rise there. So, yeah, the economy is booming right
yeah.
now.
And I guess this is one of Eisenhower's big projects that he was famous for was the highway system.
Right. He invests in infrastructure. So the highway system, schools, because
mm-hmm.
you're having all these kids and the baby boom, you're going to need schools to house them. So a lot
yeah.
of schools are being built. And which you need have jobs for people to build those things, which improves the economy even more because people have work, they have money to burn.
Mm-hmm.
And so, yeah, there's a lot of going on in that regard. This is the age of television.
Mm-hmm.
The American Western, I remember reading somewhere that they thought that the American Western was kind of dying by 1960, which... If you look at the fact that by 1959, there were 30 TV Westerns premiering in primetime. In 1959 alone.
30.
30 of them.
How many channels are we talking about?
This is 3 channels.
So they're cranking out Westerns.
They're cranking them out, man. And I think PBS is coming about at this point, which yeah. I don't know if they really...
I don't think PBS really hits the ground until the late 60s.
So, yeah, so this...
Even though there was work on it at this point.
We're talking like 3 channels for the most part.
Mm-hmm.
30 of them. In the years from between 1950 and 1969, that 20-year period there, there are hundreds of Westerns mm-hmm. being produced, including in 1959, Bonanza being the first weekly television series to be broadcast completely in color.
Wow, as early as 1959.
1959, that's one of my favorite TV Westerns.
Wow.
And then also Rawhide is premiering in 1959,
mm-hmm.
which will launch another great Western star to stardom,
mm-hmm.
Which we'll talk about, I'm sure, in a later date.
You're not going to say his name?
All right. It's Clint Eastwood.
It's Clint Eastwood.
It's Clint Eastwood.
We all know.
We all know. But no, this is... TV is just...
Exploding, really.
Exploding. 87% of families owned a TV.
Uh-huh.
That's unheard of prior to that, especially TV.
If you look
10 technology.
Years earlier, 1949, TV is very much like at the very early stages of becoming adopted in America.
Right. So,
but one of the first TV shows near and dear to my heart is The Lone Ranger, which is, of course, a Western.
Yeah.
So the Western is a major part of the television landscape, which has a big impact on Western films, I think.
Yeah.
I think one of the reasons you have such small... personal Western movies that are more psychological. Like, they depend more on character and drama
mm-hmm.
to drive them than they do big special effects, is because, or stunts, or the usual Western
right.
kind of storylines that are stock, is because those stock storylines and approaches were all being seen on television. So you had to either be smarter than TV or bigger than TV.
And
if you couldn't afford to be bigger, you had to be smart.
A lot of people went bigger, too, and particularly in the early 1960s.
Yes.
You have The Magnificent Seven, and
mm-hmm.
a great film. This is the 1950s. One of my favorite films is called The Big Country,
mm-hmm.
Gregory Peck. It's a big
mm-hmm.
sweeping Western. I like it. Anyway, but a lot of other stuff, including the space race. This, of course, is the Cold War. The Cold War has just started a few years earlier in 1946. So the Russians have gotten Sputnik out.
Mm-hmm.
And we're scrambling behind trying to catch up. By 1959, we have named our 7 astronauts for the Mercury, or the Project Mercury. So the NASA is formed in the 1950s.
Mm-hmm.
And then, of course, that just kind of gives you an indication of what the Cold War is looking like at that point as
yeah.
well. Because atomic energy is still a hot topic, no pun intended. we're actually adding 2 more... states to the Union in 1959. You know who the last states were to enter the Union?
I believe it's Alaska and Hawaii.
That is correct. That is the 49th and 50th states.
Finally knew the answer to one of your questions.
Alaska and Hawaii.
Don't feel like such a complete idiot anymore.
The Barbie doll is launched in
yes.
1959.
Speaking of consumer goods.
Yeah, toys. Singer Buddy Holly dies January 5th, which inspired the line "The Day the Music Died" by Don
mm-hmm.
McLean's American
mm-hmm.
Pie.
Yeah,
which is a big event here. Lincoln Memorial Design is put on the U.S. penny in 1959.
Wow.
Vince Lombardi signs a 5-year contract with the Green Bay Packers. If you're a Packers fan, you definitely know
mm-hmm.
that name. Cyprus gains its independence. Jimi Hendrix, and this I put this out here because it caught my eye. Jimi Hendrix, rock and roll guitarist, plays his first gig in the Temple de Hirsch synagogue basement. And this is in Seattle. He is fired from the band after the first set due to wild playing.
Yes.
We should talk about Jimi
Hendrix. The world was not ready.
Not ready for Jimi Hendrix quite yet. But this is only 1959.
But rock and roll is cool. Definitely an emerging...
Definitely. Elvis Presley
yeah,
is top.
It's happening.
Ricky Nelson.
Yep. Chuck Berry.
Yeah, Chuck Berry.
All of that is
absolutely.
Happening.
Let's see. The Dalai Lama flees China in 1959. So that's going on
mm-hmm.
Overseas. First Grammy Awards. They award Perry Como and Ella Fitzgerald. Japanese Americans regain their citizenship, and this caught my eye because of we tend to think of 1950s America as very white. So just think about Japanese Americans were put in camps during World War II after Pearl Harbor. So this is 42. Yeah. This is 59 if they're regaining their citizenship.
It's a long time.
That is a very long time. And also kind of going back up to my list here, this is the beginning of what we know today as the civil rights movement.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of stuff's going on in the 1950s. Brown versus Board of Education, 1954. Rosa Parks was arrested in 1955. The bus boycott, 55 to 56.
Yeah. A lot of things people think about when they think of the 60s.
Yeah.
But they're actually starting much earlier.
Much earlier. Little Rock 9, 1957, where schools are integrated. The Greensboro sit-in in 1960.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, these things are happening
in that so there's, time period. There's this kind of, like, prosperity in this sort of, like, white suburbia that's rising up and sort of like this almost putting the world in order sort of attitude.
Yeah, but that's the way to think about it, because coming out of World War II, that's what a lot of white Americans
were. Yeah, there was all this destruction and devastation from a depression followed by a world war, and then they're sort of trying to create this system. But even almost right away, there's sort of a recognition of the corruptions of the system. And that kind of grows and grows as, you know, new music comes in, new cultural touchstones.
Yeah.
New ideas about race and class and all these sorts of things in America.
One of the big things, and it's interesting to think about all that happening and comparing it to what's happening today.
Mm-hmm.
'Cause there are a lot of new ideas and a lot of people groups trying to gain a lot more acceptance.
Yeah.
And fear.
Yeah.
A lot of fear.
There's a lot of fear in the 1950s,
too. A lot of fear in the 1950s from atomic energy or atomic weapons.
Uh-huh.
What are the Russians going to do? And I think one of the key things to that, and I'm going to drop a name here. You may have heard of Joe McCarthy.
Yes.
McCarthyism.
Driven a lot by fear.
Plays on this fear.
Yeah.
And you kind of hear about the spies being in the government. There have been actually a couple of big incidents in the 1950s, including Adjil Hiss and the Rosenbergs.
Right.
And
as far as McCarthyism goes in the Blacklist,
yeah.
Are there any people that you know of that we've talked about so far who were involved in the Blacklist?
Involved in the Blacklist? I haven't.
I haven't come across any. But I'm sure there must have been someone. Particularly screenwriters were hit really hard by the Blacklist. Yeah.
But
don't know that there's anyone specific that we've covered.
Well, especially that I'm not a big screen. You bring up the writers much more than I have in these few episodes. Yeah.
There's no one specific that I can think of, but certainly the Western genre would be impacted by a lot of great, talented screenwriters.
Kind of bringing it back to High Noon. High Noon is hit very hard by this.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, bringing it full circle, Rio Bravo is the response to High Noon.
Mm-hmm.
And so there is this split in political and cultural identity for mass media.
Yeah.
Where you have the one set kind of talking about, I don't think they're necessarily always overtly socialist, even though they're painted with that brush. Mm-hmm. And then the other side who's ultra conservative, American way type of thing, and they're both talking about the First Amendment of like freedom of speech, or like what does it mean to be an American?
Yeah,
and I think that's one of the big things the 1950s is talking about here.
Yeah,
is this is America, and what does that mean? So you talk about whether it's High Noon or Rio Bravo, or if it's African American versus white
suburbia.
Thank you. It's talking about what it means to be an American. And this is just kind of a powder keg ready to explode, and we see it happen in the 1960s.
Yeah.
And that brings us to the future.
Yes. Anything else about the 50s that you wanted to cover? I would bring up the rise of, speaking of like fear, I would mention the rise of kind of horror films.
Oh.
In the 1950s. The horror, universal monster movies were a big success in the 30s and 40s, of course. But at this point, because of atomic energy, there's a lot of fear of what that might do and what might be created. So
I think that would make a great series all of its own.
It would. So you have, like, The Day the Earth Stood Still by Robert Wise.
You have Godzilla.
Godzilla coming out of Japan, which is fascinating stuff socially.
And before that, Creature from 50,000 Fathoms.
Right.
Them. The Thing from Outer Space, because there's actually a lot of fear about aliens. UFOs were kind of a thing coming out.
World War II. Space race is going on.
Right. So people are looking to the stars.
People are thinking about that and wondering what's out there. And Howard Hawks makes The Thing from Another World.
He produces it.
Yes. Yeah. Correct. So that ties us in nicely back to Rio Bravo.
Such a fascinating decade.
Yeah. We're already running long on this episode, but I think we could run even longer because there's so much to talk about.
There is. So our next episode, though, will be on the 1960s.
Yes.
Which we are still debating on what to pick for our 1960s Western.
Yes.
If
you have feedback, there is still time. Let us know what Western you want us to cover for the 1960s.
On Twitter, Facebook, however you want to communicate with us. We have an email address, of course.
Yeah, and if you have thoughts about Rio Bravo or something that we missed that you want us to talk about it, let us know. You can send us an email, popstorian@gmail.com. Yeah.
All right.
Thanks very much for listening.
Thank you.
We hope you enjoyed this Westerns by the Decade episode. Be sure to subscribe and share us with your friends. We'd love to have some more Pop Story and listeners out there. And we'll see you next time.
Thanks for listening to the Popstorian podcast. Be sure to subscribe. You can find us online at popstorian.com or on Facebook and Twitter. Tune in next time for more of the history of popular culture.
So long, Chris.
See you, Ben.
We're not actually leaving each other
at this moment,
but...